Going to look this morning at the difference that the risen Jesus makes by looking at what he gives. I'm going to stick pretty much to the account here and then think about some of the thoughts that we're invited to by John. Jesus arrives in the middle of the room, we're told. The door is shut, it's locked, and Jesus arrives there. He's not come through the door. His body is a different kind of body, but it's Jesus. They recognize him. One of the things, the first things, the obvious thing we see at that point. Just have a look at verse 19. Then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, Jesus came. We could stop there. What does Jesus bring? What does Jesus give? Firstly, he gives life. They saw him crucified. They saw him dead. They saw him down from the cross and into this tomb. This man had been buried. And here he is, standing in the middle of the room. Reports have come from Mary. And reports have come from the two disciples on the road to Emmaus in Luke's Gospel. They've heard, but they've not seen. And now Jesus stands in front of them. He is alive. The death he has suffered, he has reversed. He has defeated. He has conquered. And here he is, alive. And the significance of that is this. Have a look at the last verse that Peter read for us this morning, verse 31. It's not just that Jesus is alive, it's that he gives life. These things are written, says John, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. A risen Jesus offers, gives life. Okay? Imagine if you would. A young man sets up a gardening business, and these few weeks are his first few weeks, and he's after some customers. He has a few, but not many. He's walking down your street, and he's looking at front gardens to see if, well, the owner of the house needs a little bit of help. And probably your street is like my street. There are some gardens the young man would just walk past because they're already in mint condition. It's clear either someone else is doing it, the owner, or another gardener. There's no business there for him. But he may stop at yours. I hope I'm not being rude there. Aren't? He may stop at your garden. And he may knock on your door. And he may hand you a leaflet and say, I'm a gardener. And somehow politely suggest that you could use his services. Okay, maybe there's a few more weeds than you like. Maybe the grass is a little bit longer and the hedge is looking like a funny shape. I'm a gardener. And if you'd like my help, please phone. I'll do some work in your garden for you. The implication is you need what he can give. Okay? Simple, isn't it? When Jesus talks about giving life, the assumption is we need what he gives. That begs this question, what kind of life is he talking about? Because you and I are alive. It's clearly not physical life, is it? It's clearly not the life that flows through our bodies now. The life that Jesus offers is a different kind of life to just the physical. But it is eternal life. Okay? It's described in the scriptures in two ways. It's eternal, because it talks about the quality of life. We'll look at that in a bit. And it's everlasting, because of the length of life. Now, a few years ago, I entered into my 40s. And it's clear already that my body is just starting to slow down. Okay? As well as the mind. All right? Okay? And I know some of you told me, don't grow old. That's not good advice. You can't really stop that. We know that the body is going to decay, don't we? And we can be light-hearted and flippant, but that's not something to laugh about really, is it? It's serious stuff. And so when Jesus offers everlasting life of a different caliber, a different quality, surely we'd be wise to listen. He offers life because he is alive and that forevermore. Where do you see what he says in a different part of John's Gospel? John chapter 3, verse 36. This opens up a window of understanding of the life that he offers. He who believes in the Son has everlasting life. And he who does not believe in the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. The wrath of God is God's anger against sin that ruins his world and our relationship with him. He who believes in the Son has everlasting life. Lovely, thank you. I've just managed to break the machine, so you might have to flick the screens on, okay? He who believes in the Son has everlasting life. Who does not believe in the Son, does not receive him, shall not see life, but the wrath of God remains on him. Jesus defines life not as being physically alive, but as believing in him. Do you see that? Life is determined in believing in Jesus. That's when we are alive. That's when we become alive, when we start to believe. I wonder, Sam, if we could see the next bit. John chapter 17, verse 3. This is where he defines it. This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. One of the wonderful starts in the Gospel of John is that John records that Jesus come from, in the older language, from the bosom of the Father. Okay, you can't get more intimate than Jesus was with the Father. There is a closeness there. And he has come not to say, I know God and you don't, but he's come to say, I know God. Come and know him too. He's come to reveal him. Okay? And therefore, a relationship with Jesus is by definition a relationship with God. But this is life, not the physical stuff only, but life knowing Jesus Christ. Jesus offers life. Sam, I wonder if you could turn there. Jesus offers life. But that's not all he offers here. He offers peace. You see what Jesus says in verse 19? Peace be with you. That's his first word, peace. It's not the only time he says it. Have a look at verse 21. He says to them again, having shown them his wounds. He says, peace to you. And then a third time, the following week, he's with Thomas, who has insisted he won't believe unless he sees and touches and knows. And his message to Thomas, verse 26, is peace. A long time ago, before Jesus stepped on this earth, God promised there would be peace. And not just peace, but he promised there would be a person of peace. Sam, can we have the next screen, please? This will probably look familiar. We often read this around Christmas time. Isaiah 9. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Peace will come through a person. Okay? And it's one of four wonderful names there. Prince of Peace. Now, it's easy to talk of peace. It's easy to talk of a person coming and bringing peace. But later on in Isaiah, we're told how he will bring peace. And this is I want you to play spot the difference between what we see next, thank you, Sam, and what you've seen in John's Gospel. Isaiah 53 is a song about one who is sent from heaven called the servant, who is the same rank and position as God. But this servant will do something incredibly mysterious. He will suffer. And the explanation in Isaiah 53 is why he will suffer. What purpose is his suffering? This is the purpose of his suffering. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed. Spot the difference? The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. Jesus is standing in John 20 in front of his disciples. What has he done in verse 20? John chapter 20, verse 20. Have a look. He shows them his hands and his side. He shows them his wounds, his stripes, if you like. He shows them. And then he says to them, peace. Here is the person of peace, the Prince of Peace, showing that Isaiah 53 has been lived out in his body and his dying and his rising. And he gives peace to those who are in front of him. And the peace that Jesus speaks of has its roots in that word shalom in the Old Testament. This complete integral well-being of God's people when God keeps his promises ultimately. When he perfects everything, when he restores all the things that have gone wrong, then God's people will know peace. But it's not just a future experience. It's as God keeps his promises, his people know peace. In little glimpses, if you like, little drops of the great flood of joy that will come when he keeps his promises completely. And this is the peace that he offers here to all the disciples. It's not just peace, nor indeed life. Only that Jesus gives. It's also joy. It's joy. Have a look at verse 20. Verse 20. And when he had said this, the greeting of peace, he showed them his hands and his side. And then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Some words just lose their meaning, don't they? Good, nice, become neutral, ineffective. The word glad doesn't carry the weight in our language as glad does in the Greek. It's a joyfully heavy word. Okay? It's not just you've heard of your football team winning and you're glad. Or you've had a nice meal and you're glad. Or you've been able to sit out in the sun yesterday afternoon and you're glad. It's not just that kind of gladness. This is a gladness. This is a joy that knows that there are enemies outside the room who have wanted Jesus dead. There are enemies outside the room who want his followers dead. But that doesn't matter half as much now that Jesus is alive. And these followers of Jesus will follow Jesus in all sorts of paths and know all sorts of tribulation. That's the word that Jesus told them would come. And they will know suffering. And they will know, many of them, death because of what they believe. But there is joy. They are glad because Jesus is alive now, and that changes everything, see? This is something that Jesus promised himself to bring. Can I ask you just to flick back a few pages to John chapter 16? John chapter 16. The scene is the night before Jesus is betrayed. So that we're just a few days away from where we are in John 20, okay? And here Jesus is with his disciples. And in John chapter 16, he's talking to them, teaching them about things that will come. John 16, verse 20. Have a look at this. Most assuredly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. Now, that's a description of what will happen when Christ is crucified. People will be glad. They mocked Jesus while he died. And they're glad that it's happened. The world is. But the disciples know weeping and lamenting. And you will be sorrowful, says Jesus, but your sorrow will be turned into joy. And we're not told whether that phrase, that sentence came to the disciples' mind when Jesus appeared to them, showed them his wounds and said, "Peace be to you." We're not told whether the penny dropped at that point or not. But the point is this, Jesus promised they would know joy again. And they have. They have known joy. The risen Jesus gives joy. So there's three things there. There is life through Jesus. There is peace from Jesus. And there is joy in the knowledge that Jesus is alive. And as the passage goes on, there's just a few other thoughts I want to share with you. The first one is this. This is a credible account and a credible truth to embrace, that Jesus is alive. There's lots of talk recently, isn't there, about pensions. We can now do with our pensions what we want. Okay? And the media is full of warnings. Be careful. People will phone you up. They'll write to you. And they'll ask for your details to get access to your money. You've got to ask them questions. Who are they? How have they got your details? What will they do with your money? Get advice from them. What's all that advice about? That advice is about, is that person, is that organisation credible? Are they trustworthy? Can you give them a chunk or all of your pension pot and ask them to look after it? Is it in safe hands? The idea of Jesus coming back to life can sound, frankly, ridiculous. But as we go on in this account, we see the unbelieving Thomas, who wasn't there the first day, ask questions that most of you and I would ask as well. We want what the other disciples have had. We want sight. We want to see too. They've seen him. He's appeared to them in this room. And Thomas said, "Well, unless I get what you get, I'm not going to believe." That encounter happens. Thomas is confronted tenderly and lovingly by Jesus Christ. And the insistence of putting his hands in his side and touching the nail marks in his hands, that's never lived through. Although Jesus invites that, Thomas never quite gets there. It seems that he cries out in faith, verse 28, "My Lord and my God," without even touching Jesus at all. I suggest to you, here is a credible account of an unbelieving man who wanted to believe and now does believe. If you read through the resurrection accounts, there's almost humour as we watch broken-hearted people not seeing who's right in front of them. But there's always tenderness in Jesus. And there's always time for people to take different paths to faith. Some come quickly. John records that he believed at the empty tomb. Luke records that Peter goes home from the empty tomb still wondering what's actually happened. There's credible stories surrounding this. This is a story of ordinary people coming to faith in a risen Jesus Christ. It is credible. And the significance of that is this. This is what God has decided to leave. He's decided to leave people's eyewitness account to you and to me. He's decided for us to take that path. To believe because it's recorded. To see through faith, not through sight. And as implausible as that may seem, you may find yourself being willing and enabled to believe, you may find actually you do believe that this once dead, now risen Jesus appeared to his disciples, bearing the marks of his crucifixion, speaking peace and offering life. You may find yourself believing and wanting to believe. That's not a natural reaction. That's God speaking and calling you to believe. This is credible. Secondly, we'll not spend much time on this one. It is consistent. The thought came here, the disciples are in the room, they're fearful. It's as if the world has crumbled. Okay? Possibly there's a sense of guilt. Peter has voiced a commitment to die with Jesus, and all the other disciples have joined in. But when the tough time came and Jesus arrested, they all flee. And when the tougher time came for Peter, he denies Jesus adamantly 3 times. Possibly, as well as the fear that's recorded, possibly there's guilt. Possibly there's shame because of that guilt as well. Likely there's confusion. What are we going to do next? Where do we go? Certainly there's ignorance. They do not know what is there. And into all of that mix, Jesus steps in and shines his light of order in the chaos, truth into the ignorance, and peace into guilt and fear and shame. And God has done this all the time. I'm going to give you one example because of time. Just one example. When Adam and Eve were in the garden and they sinned and they broke that relationship with God that they had, and that was felt in their own relationship between each other, it's God who steps in. It's God who steps in and clothes them. They are knowingly and shamefully naked for the first time. And it's God who steps in and clothes them. There is account after account after account throughout the Old and the New Testament where God steps in and tenderly meets the needs of people. And here it is again. Fearful, Jesus steps in and speaks peace. It's consistent with the character of God. Into the chaos, there's beautiful order, knowledge, truth, peace, life, joy. That's what God does. Then lastly, I want you to note this. All this comes because these people are connected to Jesus by faith. We are physically alive. Jesus offers life. We may know peace, but it's not the peace that comes from Jesus. We may know the peace of a quiet afternoon. We may know the peace that we know that someone else is well. We may know the peace that we have done all our best at work and we can rest after a busy day. We may know peace in all kinds of ways, but this peace that Jesus is offering is not the peace that comes through those things. This peace comes through knowing that God is not just with you, but for you. That your broken relationship with God has not just been mended a little bit, but eternally, securely fixed. And this peace word of shalom, this complete well-being, will have moments of experience here, and ultimately one day will be our complete experience forever. It's because of Jesus. You may know moments of joy in your life. You may hold a newborn baby, and that baby may be from your family. And there's joy, not just in your heart, in the heart of others. There may be a success. Children do well in exams, and they go on to do the things that they want to. And you are joyful, you're thankful. There's joy in heart. But that's not the joy that we're talking about here. This joy comes because we know that Jesus is alive. That's the source of the joy. And so the life, the peace, the joy that this passage, that the scriptures talk of, is not man-made, see. It comes only through Jesus Christ. Now, Sam, I wonder if you could put the rest of the screen up, and with this I'll finish. Two applications, if I can, as we sort of look at this together. The first one is this. There can be in this record a confrontation. It could be you think you've got things sorted, you've got life, you know peace, you know joy, but actually none of it is connected to Jesus Christ. There's a confrontation here. Jesus stands in the room of the day before the disciples, showing his wounds, and from that comes life, peace, and joy. There is a confrontation. The life you have without Jesus Christ is not ultimately one of life, eternal life. It's not one of peace with God. It's not one of joy knowing God. That comes only from Jesus. There's a confrontation there. But with the confrontation comes a call. Maybe you know what it is to drive down the motorway, and there are signs on the left-hand side, tiredness kills. It's no accident, is it, that a mile down the road there's somewhere to stop, is it? The idea is as a warning. If you're tired, rest. And let us provide you somewhere to spend all your money on a cup of coffee. Okay? There's this warning. Tiredness kills. And it can. And then there's this provision, this invitation. Come here and rest. There is this confrontation with Jesus. You won't get life. You won't get peace. You won't get joy without Jesus Christ. That's the warning. And the call, the invitation is come. Come and have it. Come and receive this gift from God. One of the most sobering and yet sweet warnings and calls in the Bible is through the prophet Jeremiah. God's talking to the people, and it's as if they've made pots to carry water, and the pots are cracked and broken, and they're trying to drink from these cracked pots that won't hold the water. And all the time there's a living fountain behind them, and they've turned their back on the living fountain, and they're trying to lick bits of water off the cracked pot. It doesn't make sense. There's a warning. That's what your life is like without Jesus. You want life. You want peace. You want joy. Nobody wants an absence of those things. You want those things. But they're found only in Jesus. So there's this confrontation. And there's this call, this invitation. And we enter a relationship with Jesus Christ through faith. Through believing that, do you remember? He lived, he died, and he rose again. The children can remember it, just. And believing that he did those things to put you right and me right with God, and to bless us with gifts that only heaven can give into earth. Life forever. Relationship with God. Peace with our Creator. So we know him as Father. And joy. That can never, ever, ever be taken away because it's linked to Jesus being alive. There is this confrontation and there is this call. And lastly, let me finish with this briefly. Christian, there is this comfort. This passage should comfort us. Whatever life's experience is now, the fearfulness of the disciples in the room, Jesus comes in and speaks peace. They know joy because he's alive. Whatever our experiences, we're already Christian at the fountain of living water. We're already being given the greatest gifts that heaven can give. And one day, he's going to finish that giving. He's going to perfect our souls and our bodies. He's going to restore heaven and earth. He's going to make perfect everything. And the life, the joy, and the peace will be known in a way that words fail now. But our hearts will embrace when we experience it. There's comfort. Because Jesus is alive, these things are certain. What the risen Jesus gives, very simply, when you come to receive, when you come to receive, and in receiving, Christian, will you rejoice this day that these things are freely, fully, and finally yours? Life, peace, and joy.